Welcome back to our Men's Afternoon Kollel. I want to thank the Frohlich Financial Group, our sponsors, generous sponsors of the Kollel for the year. I want to thank our sponsors for today, Shoshana Abram Sofer, in the memory of his parents, Rivka Leah Bas Rav Zev, and Rav Shmuel Menachem Ben Chaim Yaakov. Neshamos should have an aliyah. We're going to begin a new topic today. It'll take us, I think, more than 1 week. It's a topic which apparently is still in the news. It was in the news earlier this year. And that is the topic of bribery. Bribery and protection. Now you'll say, bribery, that's so irrelevant to us. Who here is involved in bribery? We are not cutting deals. We are not cutting corners. And yet bribery is something which is highly relevant, not because of any politics or current news in politics, but what was a scandal earlier the year in the college university system remains equally scandalous on a regular basis in the yeshiva system. Not locally here in South Florida, I don't think, but certainly in many other places around the world, including in our beloved and holy Eretz Yisrael. So by way of introduction, page number one, we'll go quickly through a few of these articles which capture what were the scandals that were happening.
Rabbi, we do cut
Hold on. Remember earlier this year, there was a big controversy in the question of bribing to get children into college. You remember there were several prominent arrests of prominent people who had bribed admissions officers to accept their children who otherwise didn't meet the criteria and didn't qualify. This was an article in March from a certain newspaper, whose name I don't like to acknowledge. But nonetheless, does a good job capturing the story. And it says the following. If a university coach or employee takes payment in exchange for improperly admitting a student who is not otherwise qualified, it can be a federal crime. It violates the honest services owed to the school. For the parents charged in the case, paying the bribe means that they are just as guilty for acting as an accomplice in the fraudulent scheme. So not only is the recipient of the bribe guilty of violating the law, but the one paying the bribe, whose child didn't really qualify or meet the criteria to gain entrance, but who bribed the child's way in. Mr. Kaplan was quoted as telling a cooperating witness in the case, quote, "I'm not worried about the moral issue here. I'm worried about the, if she's caught doing that, you know she's finished." Another parent charged in the case is quoted as telling a confidential informant, "I know this is craziness. I know it is. And then I need you to get him into USC, and I need you to cure cancer and make peace in the Middle East." She paid $50,000 to have someone else take the ACT exam for her son, according to the complaint. Gaming the system to get your child into a top-tier college is much the same. There's no easily identifiable victim. An applicant's denied admission may well chalk up their rejection to the luck of the draw or the unknown factors that lead one college to turn away a prospective student and another to accept that person. Of course, the action of the parents charged did cause actual harm, even if the victim's unaware of it. University admissions are largely a zero-sum game. So taking one slot means a worthy student was sent away. Not knowing who that person is does not lessen the harm. Wealth can buy a lot of access. Paying bribes to sneak your child into a favored college, though, might result in short prison terms for some of the parents. So that's the first article that tells us just how severe the crime is. And though those who perpetrated feel there is victimless, what's the difference? So you paid a little bit. You paid someone to take the test. You paid someone to admit the child. You paid someone to give them an athletic scholarship, even if they were undeserving. Who's the victim? The answer is there is a victim. Those who were qualified, those who worked hard, those who deserved to get in and didn't, there clearly is a victim, and it's a significant crime. The next article on page two also captures, there's no separate college admission system for the wealthy. Parents charged in the case as samples from a catalog of wealth and privilege. For every student admitted through fraud, an honest, genuinely talented student was rejected. He said, "We are well aware wealthy people regularly donate money to colleges to secure the matriculation of their children. The government is not attacking the conduct of that business as usual. We're not talking about donating a building so that a school is more likely to take your son or daughter," he said at the news conference. "We're talking about deception and fraud." Now, it's fascinating because he distinguished between the two, and one can argue, though one is legal, it's not necessarily more moral. And the question that we'll examine is it more halachic? Is there really a difference between smearing the admissions officer and paying to get an unqualified student into school, or smearing the whole university by naming a building, by donating a large sum of money, by fattening the endowment in order to get an unqualified student into school. The key distinction here, says the article, is not just the amount of money, but the recipient. A donation is made to a college while a bribe is paid to an employee, who in effect is stealing an admission slot, hawking it and pocketing the proceeds. So in other words, the difference is when you donate largely to an institution, everyone knows about it. The institution as a whole are the beneficiaries of it. There's a new library, there's a new dormitory, there's a new gymnasium. Everyone's benefiting, and even if they're showing favor as a result, but at least it's in a response to everyone benefiting. Whereas the admissions officer or the athletic director, pocketing money means the university as a whole gains no benefit. It's a personal benefit. That's what makes it a crime. And as I said, that distinction might be enough to separate between legal and illegal, but not necessarily between moral and immoral, and halachic and non-halachic, against halacha. Even when considering a comparable applicant's college favor the wealthy, the widespread practice of preferentially admitting the children of alumni is a fundraising technique. And for the truly wealthy, there's always the option of making a significant donation. Whether students are admitted because their parents paid for a boathouse or because their parents bribed the sailing coach, it's still the case that merit alone is not deciding the issue. Now, lest you think this is an exclusively Ivy League problem, lest you think this is an exclusively university or college problem, this problem is ubiquitous. It is pervasive within the Torah community itself. Page number 3. This was a story from several years ago, a decade ago already, almost a decade ago, where there was a scandal that Israeli yeshivas were paying the yeshiva guidance director of high schools a commission to get the best students to go to their yeshiva. It was a scandal. Vice Principal of Jewish Studies received an offer he felt compelled to refuse, $1,000 cash for every student he directed to a certain Israeli gap year yeshiva. Here it was in the opposite direction. Parents were not bribing the admissions officer, but rather the yeshiva who were fiercely competing for the best bachrim, were paying the school to recommend their yeshiva as the best option. And again, there are victims. Because when a yeshiva is going to refer, is going to suggest, is going to channel a student to a particular yeshiva, it may not be in that boy's best interest, and they may take up a slot of someone else who's more appropriate or fitting to be there. If you skip down, the article says, aside from the obvious negation of Torah principles, this calls into question what recruitment is all about. If the goal is to ensure that every student finds the place best suited for him or her, this obviously is a step in the wrong direction, to put it mildly. Turn the page again towards the bottom. The rabbi acknowledged that, quote, no yeshiva's recruitment practices are free of guilt, and called on his fellow educators to adopt a set of recruiting guidelines. Today, recruiting is still fierce, and it goes in both directions. There's fierce competition to get into the best yeshivas in seminaries, and there's fierce competition from the best seminaries and yeshivas to compete to get the best students. And there's a lot of smearing, a lot of protectia, a lot of bribery going on in both directions. If you think this is only true about American parents, turn the page. Page number 5. All of this, of course, is background before we delve into the Torah sources. Eretz Yisrael, the yeshiva system of Israel, is not immune. In the Haredi newspaper, Bechadri Chadarim, the website, it tells the story. It quotes of Steinman Zatzal, Zalom Maisa Hagun Lahadif Adam Amishneo Bishel Protectia, Kach Amar Hagun Reb Steinman. It's not decent for a person to act, to prefer one person to the other because of protexia. Someone from Reb Steinman's circle was accepted to a position. After a few hours, the management informed him that the job had been given to someone else, and when he clarified, he was informed that the position had been given to someone else due to closeness and contacts. The same person asked the Gaon why the matter happened to him, and he answered, the whole concept of protexia was done by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to strengthen us in the study of faith and security, and so we don't think we're making decisions in this world, but it's all up to him. The notion that there's corruption due to protexia should make us have more amunah in Hashem, that whatever the consequence, whatever the result, whatever the outcome is divinely ordained is from upstairs. He gives the people on the executive seat the power and examines them if they behave honestly and gives the job to those who deserve it, or behave dishonestly would be based on connections and acquaintance. Protexia is not something proper at all, concluded Reb Steinman. So protexia is immoral. It is not a Torah value, says Reb Steinman, and it exists in the top chadorim in Eretz Yisrael. I know this from family members. If you want to get a child into the top and the best and the most elite cheder, the Zayda, usually from America, has to make a nice donation. There has to be a significant donation. It's true at the cheder, at the yeshiva, the beis medrash. It's true at every single level. So this notion of protectia, whether you need to know the right people, and I'm called upon as someone with some connections, and whatever name I have is only because I represent our wonderful community. But I'm called, could you make this phone call? Could you see? Could you try? Maybe you can make it happen. That's true in the world of Torah and yeshivas. And it's also true in the world, we're going to see, we're going to examine together the question of, there's only one bed left in a nursing home, in an assisted living facility. And the bed has already been designated. But you know the owner of the assisted living facility. Could you see? Maybe at this they'll redirect the bed. They'll give it to my loved one who really needs it. It's not what you know, but it's who you know. And protectia still makes the world go round. So what does halacha, what do Torah have to say? Whether it's in this case of the college scandal, whether it's other cases of bribery that are discussed in the news. And I'll give you another example. Source number, or page number 6. Any doctors here? Any retired doctors here? None of them willing to admit it right now. So this was an article in the Washington Post a couple years ago that said the following. We all know big pharma give doctors gifts. The laws have become more strict and more narrow what type of gift you can get. I am connected on both sides of this. I have, part of my family was involved in working for big pharma. Another part of my family were doctors who were getting tickets to Broadway shows or being taken out to dinner at best, or getting lots of school supplies and pens and at the lowest level. And what are the ethics of that? What are the ethics of that? And this article says it like it is. Physicians, myself included, aren't immune to the behavioral manipulation of marketers, and big pharma know it. 2012, the pharmaceutical industry spent, you ready? This is a whopping number. It's got to be bigger than the GDP of many small countries. $24 billion marketing its premium branded drugs to healthcare professionals, 8 times the amount it spent on advertising to consumers. In other words, however many ads that you see in magazines, newspapers, and on TV, you know, the ones that spend 5 times longer telling you about the side effects than the actual drug, however much money went into promoting to consumers, 8 times more, $24 billion. Because in the end of the day, it's the doctor who takes out his or her prescription pad and is going to prescribe that medicine, can choose this, that, the other, or the generic. And as much as we think that the doctor is not affected and is not bribed, is not influenced by those box seat Yankee tickets, by those Broadway show tickets, by the delicious dinner they would never pay for themselves, they can't help but be affected. And that's why the pharmaceutical industry would not spend $24 billion, with a B, dollars, 8 times more than it does on the consumers, if it wasn't effective. In recent years, a growing segment of the medical community has spoken out against the industry in inordinate efforts to influence doctors, and so on. You could read the rest of the, article on your own, but essentially it contends, and written by a doctor, that doctors who are honest will admit they cannot help but be influenced, essentially by bribery, and not always making the best decision for the patient, not always making the best decision for the healthcare company, insurance company, the economy, not always making the best decision, but influenced. So we went from saying that bribery and protectia don't affect any of us, to if we're honest with ourselves, they probably affect almost every one of us. And we're going to go through and see now what the halacha is and some of the ethics. So we start source number 1. Pasuk says in Shmos and Perchav Gimel, V'shochad lo sikach. It's pretty explicit. There's not a lot of wiggle room there. Shochad lo sikach, ki ha-shochad ya'aver pikhim v'yisalev divrei tzadikim. Don't take a bribe, because bribes blind the clear-sighted and they upset the pleas of those who are in the right. Ha-shochad ya'aver, like lifnei iver, and ya'aver means it causes one to be blind. It clouds our judgment. You can't see clearly. Someone who's otherwise a pikeach, someone who otherwise has moral and sound judgment, becomes an iver, becomes blinded by the mighty dollar, the non-mighty shekel, the mighty Broadway tickets. V'salef divrei tzadikim. We also have a pasuk in Dvarim. Lo sata mishpat lo sakir panim. Don't judge unfairly and don't be partial. V'lo sikach shochad. And don't accept or receive a bribe. Ki ha-shochad yaver inei chachamim v'salef divrei tzadikim. So in the first pasuk, we saw that bribery is so pernicious bribery is so potent, it has the power to compromise or to influence even a pikeach, someone who thinks clearly. Here in this next pasuk in Dvarim, whom does it describe as influenced by a bribe? None other than einei chachamim. You could be a chacham, you could be wise, you could be righteous, and nevertheless, that is the power. Pasuk in Dvarim again, Aror lokeach shochad, lakos nevesh dam naki, v'amar kol ha'amamein. Cursed is the one who accepts a bribe in the case of a murder of an innocent person, and so on. And then finally, a pasuk in Tehillim. Kaspel onosam b'neshef, ashochal naki lalokach, oseila layimot liolam. Tehillim tesvav, we say it at Levayas, we say it at the Levaya of a man. Kaspel onosam b'neshef, what do we admire? What is virtuous about a person? How do we choose to capture their life and their legacy? What is David HaMelech's description of the most righteous person? Is someone who kaspel onosam b'neshech, doesn't lend with interest, but also shochal al naki lo lakach. They're not influenced by bribery. You can't buy them off. You're not able to distort their judgment by flashing an opportunity in front of their eyes. Baruch atah Adonai, Elohim HaMelech HaOlam, Shehakol Nehiyeh Baruch. The Gemara Ksubas and Daf Kofei, the Gemara gets into this. And the Gemara tells us that bribery can take on many forms. Bribery is not just money. It's not just somebody sneaking into your pocket, into your hand, or into your bank account in the Cayman Islands a little extra in order to get you to find favor for them. It says the Gemara, "Shochad lo sikach, ma tamad lomar im lalamit shelo zakos lachayvus lachayvus hazakai harei kvar nemar lo sata mishpat lo sita mishpat." Pasuk already says you're not allowed to distort justice. So what is not accepting a bribe? What does that add to not distorting justice? If you're going to find the guilty innocent, or you're going to find the innocent guilty, that is already a violation of the other part of the pasuk. Lo satem mishpat. What is added right afterwards with lo sikach shochad? Says the Gemara, ela afil zakos is a zakos lechayv esachayv amra Torah v'shochad lo lokach. Unbelievable. Gemara says, not only have you violated the prohibition of bribery when it distorts your judgment, but even if you remain consistent or steadfast to your judgment, you're unchanged in your conclusion. So, you have a student with a 4.0 GPA, who got a 1600 on the SATs, who was part of every extracurricular and did an internship for the Supreme Court, and finished Shas at the age of 5, and has impeccable midos, and was the captain of the basketball team, and the midos team, and you were always going to accept them. From day one, they were going to be accepted. But nevertheless, when the parent who wanted to just make sure gave you a little extra, you took it. It didn't make you accept them. Or somebody had no qualifications. And even though the parent tried to bribe you, you rejected them. And now you're a lowlife, because not only did you reject them, you accepted the bribe. So there too, one is in violation. The Gemara Ksubas concludes. Why should that be? Why should it be a prohibition of the bribe, a violation of the bribe, even if it didn't change your outcome, even if it didn't change your behavior?
It has to have an effect psychologically.
But it didn't change the outcome. How do you know it had an effect? So it always has an effect. I think, Lenny, you said this last time I taught this, you or your wife, suggested that it has an effect sometimes even in the opposite direction. Maybe you were going to accept them, but you rejected them because you didn't want it to appear you accepted a bribe, even though you accepted the bribe. Meaning, even when it looks like it didn't influence your judgment, maybe it influenced it in that it tried to make it look like you didn't influence your judgment. We don't always have such self-awareness. We can't always understand. We have a blind spot within our own lives. So even when it looks like it didn't influence us, the Gemara is telling us that the prohibition of receiving a bribe, the prohibition of participating or showing favor based on protectia is forbidden, even when it doesn't look like it changed the way we do things. So the Gemara here in Ksubas, on Kofei, both Amud Aleph and then turning over to Amud Beis, gives us other examples of the way a bribe works. Not only with money. The Gemara continues, "Debay Amarava, my time at the Bishokta, Kevin the Kavli Shokta, Minei, Ikravi Daita Legabei, Vahavi Kigufei." Why is a bribe prohibited? Because once the judge accepts a bribe, his thoughts, a person becomes ikriva ladaite, legabe. You become more connected. The person has invested in you, and now, reciprocally, you are invested in them. V'havikagufe. And you become like one. Ve'ein adam roach chovel atzmo. My shochad, in fact, what is the etymology of the word shochad? Says the Gemara, shehu chad. That you and they become one. Kigufe. A person smears you, they put a little something in your pocket, they give you an opportunity you otherwise didn't have. You cannot help but see them more favorably, feel more connected. Shochad, shehu chad. That you now are interconnected. Do not sit in judgment. Do not be a judge either for somebody who has been kind to you or the son of the chazalei chova. Because somebody who is you have a loving, kind relationship with, you're never going to find them guilty. Somebody who's your enemy, you'll never be willing to see their innocence. You'll never exonerate. And the Gemara gives examples. Now, Amar Rava. Then give an example of where this comes out. But skipping down, look on the English side. It's not necessary, to say that this includes bribery by means of money. Even verbal bribery, assisting by means of speech, is also prohibited. The halacha that a bribe is not necessarily money is derived from the pasuk that says, do not take any profit. The Gemara says, what are the circumstances of bribing with words? And explains, it's demonstrated by an episode involving Shmuel. He was once crossing a river on a narrow ferry. Shochad lo lekach ein tzarich lomar shochad mamon lafidu shochad dvarim nami asur midolok tziv betzal lo sikach heichadami shochad dvarim. What's an example of shochad with words dvarim? Ki yada Shmuel havaavre b'mebra. Shmuel was once crossing the river. Also gavre yav leyadei. He gave him his hand. Someone assisted Shmuel. Can you imagine? They carried him. They made the light turn green. They gave his hand and helped him across the street. He said, what are you here for? He said, I have a din. That's it. Disqualified. I'm disqualified. I can't sit. Why? Because you did me a favor. Ah, that's a big favor. There's no wiring of money taking place. There's no front row seats at the Yankee game happening. By the way, anyone gets me front row tickets to the Yankee game, I'm happy to be bribed on anything. Is that recorded? Anyway, but so there's no wire transfer, and yet shochad bidvarim. You can flatter somebody and violate bribery. You can find favor. You can help somebody up the stairs. You can help them cross the river. You can help them cross the street. Each of these are examples where if someone has done a tova to you, what do you feel towards them? What do you owe them? How do we describe it in the vernacular? You owe them a debt of gratitude. You owe them a favor, or you owe them a debt of gratitude. How do you pay them that favor? By being favorable towards them. How do you pay off that debt of gratitude? By returning an act of kindness towards them. So if someone's done something for us, whether they transferred actual money, or they simply did something kind, in either case, says the Gemara Ksubas, that is a violation of shochad. So shochad's not just with money, shochad could be with a favor or with words. Yes? Right.
Is suspect. So if we wanted to get a variance for the show,
yeah,
we would hire plugged-in lawyers, lobbyists.
100%.
And to create that kind of identity of interest.
That's correct. That's exactly right. So that's what we're going to discuss for the remainder of this week and next is what are the boundaries, what are the parameters, what are the guidelines from a Torah and halachic perspective, and we'll see many different scenarios because the best way to learn is with case studies. We'll take several case studies and try to apply it. But you're 100% right. That's the way that society works. Overtly, whether explicitly or implicitly. Right? So smearing the admissions director is illegal. It's a felony. You go to jail. But donating the library, you're a grace at tzaddik, and they put your name up, and they have a big event, and they drop a big banner. Even though both, you're essentially trying to use the same means to bring about the same outcome. So whether you're using a relationship with, I mean, again, I really hesitate to say this on a recording, particularly since some of our enemies try to use this in a way against us, but all of politics is trying to say, if you align your values with mine and your policies with mine, I then have an interest in helping you stay in office. That is the polite way of describing it. The more impolite way of describing it is, money buys influence. I mean, that's the whole That's all politics is, campaign financing, and campaign needs money, and basically, hopefully, it's not bribing, because hopefully, in some world, the politicians have scruples and values, and they cannot be influenced. They're just finding the people aligned with them to support them. But yeah, whether it's universities, whether it's yeshivas, whether it's hospitals, who gets the best bed or the single room in the hospital is the person whose name is in the lobby on the wall. That's who's going to get it. And that's how it all works. So lobbying, advocacy, and so on. Yes?
What about the other way? You do something good for somebody and they hate you for it.
Yeah, that's called the rabbinate. He said, what about when you do nice things for people and they hate you?
Because they feel that they owe you.
Correct. Some people act that way. And by the way, but that's exactly what the Gemara concluded. So when someone did something nice for you, but you hate to feel indebted, so you go out of your way to show that you're not showing them favor, then too you've been influenced.
That's bribery.
That's bribery too. It's a bribery with an unintended negative result. But that too is a form of bribery. Every child of an educator knows that the worst nightmare is to be in your own parents' class. Why? Why? Because the child knows that the parent who's the teacher has to go out of their way to show. Every kid who makes the team, whose parent is the coach of the team, knows it's a nightmare worst case scenario. Because the coach parent has to go out of their way to show that they're not going to give more playing time. So sometimes bribery can have the negative influence, and that's what the Gemara was concluding from the Pasuk. Was not only when it changes your judgment favorably, but even if it didn't change or it didn't at least seem to change the outcome at all, that too is usur. Even if it doesn't corrupt justice, that too is usur and unethical. The Rambam source number 7.
So if we sponsor a week,
if you sponsor the afternoon, I told you I'm very open to. We're trying to build our campus. I'm very open to build to bribery. Source 7. The Rambam has somewhat of a chiddush, and he says, not only is the prohibition of the violation on the one who receives or takes the bribe, but there's a prohibition on a violation by the one who gives the bribe as well. Why? Because lifnei iver lo sitein mechshol. It's interesting. The fact that the Rambam says lifnei iver means it's not shochad. Unless he's saying in addition to shochad, it's lifnei iver. It's a very cute pun on words, because shochad is yaver, and this is lifnei iver. So it's the ultimate lifnei iver, right? We all know that we darshan the pasuk lifnei iver is dafka not talking about a blind person. It's unclear if you actually stick your foot at and cause a blind person a trip, if you even violated lifnei iver. Ad kedekach hazal darshan that lifnei iver is not talking about an actual blind person. So interesting, the Rambam here says, we are also susceptible and vulnerable. We're blind to our own ability to be influenced. That davka lifnei iver is the on shochad, which is yaver, the chachamim or the pikchim. Yes.
The Rambam limiting the iser of giving shochad to lifnei iver.
So right, meaning is it also a violation of shochad?
That they're not involved in the iser shochad at all.
No. He says here it's a lav of lifnei iver. The giver is over the lava of the Fnever and the recipient of the lava of Shochad. Rabbeinu Yonah Shari Tshuva source, Shochad lo sikach. Afilu amenas lezakas lezakev, lechayev es lechayev. Ve'af b'shizki m'shnei anoshim asher lemariv v'aseis lo schar b'shudfus. Kach amur Rabbi Sein, it's chron levrocha, not to schar lo adun dinav b'telem. What happens if both litigants decide together, you know what? The dayan, case of a dan yechidi or the bezdin, they're giving of their time. So you know what? Let's agree even before we begin the Din Torah, because one of them would never agree to this after the Din Torah, but let's agree even before we begin the Din Torah that these three Dayanim are about to give us their time, and they're about to hear our case, and they're about to help us come, hopefully, to a reconciliation. So let's buy them a $500 gift certificate to a fancy steak restaurant. Let's give them each a bottle of single malt scotch to thank them for the time, and then we'll begin the Din Torah. Says Rabbeinu Yonah, Aser. Not allowed to. Hanotel scharo ladon dina betalim. Av our shiny tin laschara after the shiafsid of Bashir Yafriu massive. The only thing you could pay Dayanim is schar batala. In order to give those 2 hours, you had to take off of your normal job. Normally, you get paid to be a Rebbe, to be a Machanech, to be a Rav, to be a Sheikhet, to be a lawyer, to be a doctor. Normally, you get paid in the hedge fund. And you took time off of that to hear this Din Torah, so you can be paid schar batala. to offset what you forfeited. But you can't get paid outright for what you're doing because that's shochad. So says Rabbeinu Yonah, where's the shochad? Both litigants, both parties are dividing the single malt. So you're not going to show favor to one over the other, but now you're going to show favor to both. Even when it says Rabbeinu Yonah, Amenas lezakos lezakar, lechayev is lechayev, it's still. You can't give one more than the other. We have all kinds of rules that regulate how the Dini Torah should work. So this is true not only in the context of an actual, bless you, Din Torah, but it's true in general, in life. We are all subject to influence. It clouds our judgment. It blinds the otherwise wise and righteous. And the Torah therefore cautions, as we saw in several places, and with great severity, the prohibition of bribery, the prohibition of accepting or receiving a bribe. Sfasem is source number 9. Sfasem says, Lo sikach shochad v'atam ki ha-mishpat l'alokim hu. V'kadosh baruch hu nosol lanu koach ha-mishpatim shebetorah. Shebezeh zochen lishpat mishpat ha-emes. Shenifshpat mishamayim. Hadon din emes la'amito perish l'shmo. Kedei l'eskasher be'emes ha'amiti. Rak ha'idei bakashas ha'emes b'koach toras ha'emes yichon lizdabik b'shor sh'emes. Aber kashadona yidei shochad afilu hu tzodek eino yachol lizkasher b'shor sh'emes ve'eino la'amito. So Sfas Emes in Parsha Shoftim says the following. We have an expression, the Gemara at the beginning of Sanhedrin, it's used several times in Sanhedrin. Hadon din emes la'amito. A person who executes judgment in truth. I don't even know if that's an accurate translation. Hadon din emes la'amito. Emes la'amito. It sounds redundant. How do you translate that phrase? What does that mean? To be done din emes la'amito. If it's emes, what's la'amito? If it's la'amito, so it's emes. So just say it. Done din emes. What is emes la'amito? So that's what the Sfas Emes, the Gereb is coming and he's teaching. What does it mean, emes la'amito? It means not only did you come to the right conclusion, but you came to the right conclusion in a righteous way. You can come to the right conclusion in an entirely unholy way. You have to come to the right conclusion in a righteous way. That's emes la'amito. And what does it mean to do it in the right way? It means to do it with divine guidelines and divine inspiration. Chosam HaShel HaKadosh Baruch Hu emes, Hashem's signature is emes. He is defined by truth. And when we are guided by honesty, integrity, truth, principle, then we're done din emes la'amito. It's a din emes, it's the correct conclusion, but it's not just that it's the correct conclusion, the responsibility of Dayanim, the mandate and mission of a din Torah, of a Beis Din, is to be done din emes, not just to come to the right conclusion, but to do so la'amito, according to the one whose signature is emes, i.e. HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, to do it in a righteous way. We have a similar, the Medrash Darshan similarly, the beginning of Parsha Shoftim. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Why the redundancy? Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Just say tzedek, tirdof. Why is it tzedek, tzedek, tirdof? My brother-in-law's father is a federal judge in New York, and he has on his bench that pasuk, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. He's an observant Torah Jew, federal judge, and tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. He's decided some, including recently, some major cases, but also very involved in the 9/11 cases. And he remembers, that's his mission, that's his mandate. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. So the Medrash says, what does it mean, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof? The Medrash says, tzedek, bitzedek, tirdof. Meaning, some people in the name of a righteous end engage in unrighteous means. In order to pursue a righteous cause, they engage in unrighteous behavior. It can't just be that tzedek. We can't just pursue righteousness, but we have to pursue the tzedek, the righteousness, bit tzedek, with a sense of righteousness. So similar, emes la'amito, tzedek, 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 bit tzedek, tirdof. The Ramban, source 10. The Ramban tells us the following. Does the prohibition of bribery apply to a non-Jew? We know that non-Jews have how many mitzvahs?
Seven.
How many do we have? 613. That really expand and translate into many more. Non-Jews have 7. Where's the prohibition? Is Shochad on the list? Is Shochad on the 7 mitzvahs b'nei Noach? So the Ramban says, of Yosham Yomra Bedinin Shal Noach Hatedina Nerag Lokeach Shochad Nerag, that a Ben Noach who receives a bribe, it is liable for the death penalty. The Ramban understands that the prohibition is part of Dinim. One of the seven Noahide laws is the obligation to set up courts, obligation to set up a system of justice. And a failure to do so, in other words, enabling or allowing a corrupt society that is not functionally based on justice, is a prohibition of the Shevet Mitzvah B'nai Noach. And there's no more corrupt than bribery. So bribery, protectia, is a form of corruption that a Ben Noach is muzar, that the non-Jew is cautioned or warned in, just like the Jew. Mara writes, that's why when Levi and Shimon destroy the city of Shechem, it's a big discussion among the Rishonim, the Mefarshim, how is it that they were allowed to engage in what we call collective punishment? Collective punishment. You know, I have a friend who says, we want to get back Hadar Golden's body and Oron Ben Herzl's body. It's very simple. Turn off the lights to Gaza. Turn all the electricity and all the water off to Gaza until their bodies return. Now, I say that the leadership there is so corrupt, they'd let their own people suffer before they'd give back the bodies. Right? Okay, but let's say, you know, for a day or two they'll do that. And eventually, so what's the ethics of collective punishment? Shimon and Levi carry out collective punishment. Shechem ben Hamor is the one who violates Dina. And what do? They take it out on the whole city of Shechem. By what right did they have to? Yaakov, in fact, was critical. We know in Parshas Vayechi, Yaakov is very critical at them for their impetuous behavior. Now, was Yaakov critical because what they did was morally wrong, or because he thought it was strategically risky, because it was a mistake? So Mara says, you know what it was? Dinim. It's not collective punishment. The Mara gives a different answer. The Mara says, it's war. You can ask the same question about war. By what right do you ever have to confront another army? By what right do you have to, in a war, there are invasions, there's bombing of cities, there are civilian casualties. What right do you ever have to engage in a war in which there's civilian casualties? Isn't that a collective punishment? So Mara says, no, that's the context of war. In the context of war, then the dine ritzicha, the halachas of murder, are different. He writes, dine ritzicha are different in the context of war. But I think it's, I don't remember the Rambam, we say dinim. They violated dinim because they didn't hold Shechem accountable for what he did to Dina. Therefore, the whole city was in violation of this, one of the Shevet Mitzvah B'nai Noach. And when the whole city is in violation of the Shevet Mitzvah B'nai Noach, it's not collective punishment, but rather it's holding them all accountable and their Chayav Misa for not having dinim, for not having a system of justice and righteousness. So says the Ramban here, B'nai Noach are Musar, non-Jews also are forbidden from engaging in bribery. It is subsumed, it is included under the banner of Dinim, one of the seven Noahide laws. Rav Yosef Shaul Nathan Sun, the Shaul Meshach, source 11, has a tshuva where he discusses this, and he discusses this Ramban as well. You could look at it on your own. The Chazanish makes an interesting comment, source 12, in Amun and Bitachon.
The Goyim, they have a system of dinim,
right?
Whatever it is,
right?
They don't have our system,
correct?
So, what does that mean? What they're doing is correct? All the dinim?
If that
would be true, then we don't need our own laws.
Good. So you're asking a good question, not for now, which is what determines the fact that non-Jews are bound by a halacha? One of their seven mitzvahs is that they have to have a system of justice. Are they allowed to make it up? Do they conclude it democratically? Sodom had their own laws also. And we talk about Midas Sodom. Unethical behavior is called Midas Sodom. So is the non-Jewish society, do they democratically come to the conclusion of what their laws are? What determines their laws? Do their laws have to be consistent with Torah laws? Then they might as well be Jewish. What determines? So we know, again, we have a whole notion of Dina de Malchus Adina, which we assume is a din d'orayta, dina de malchus adina. We're bound by the laws of the government in which we live in, because that's part of dinim. So they're not necessarily guided by the Torah, the speed limit, the tax bracket, the whatever other laws of the country, and they're entitled as long as it's not against Torah. It's part of a much bigger discussion. Chazanish source 12. Hine ein azharas shochad bechlal mishpatim bechlal chukim. Chazanish makes a startling comment. He says this prohibition of accepting a bribe, is it a chok or a mishpat? Is it a rational, or does it defy rationality? Does it defy logic?
It's rational.
So I would have said it's a mishpat. It's rational. We just said it in the context of the non-Jew and dinim. It's all about maintaining a ethical society, a system of justice, a social contract between the participants of a particular society is not to accept bribery. That corrupts everything. But the Chazanish says, no, it's not a mishpat. Chazanish writes, in Amun HaBitachon, he says, Zachok, how do you know that? Shrei lo asra Torah hora la'atzmo, v'adam roa trefa la'atzmo, afim hudal, v'chol chayev tzluim ba. The halacha is that a rav, a shochet, is allowed to paskin for themselves. A shochet can paskin for themselves on the chicken they shechted. A rav can paskin for themselves on the wife's nidashailas. And you see, Tosfos says that explicitly, you see that you're allowed to paskin for yourself. If you're higil lahara, if you're somebody qualified, you're allowed to paskin for yourself. And there's ein shochet gedola mizu. There's no greater sense of having an interest, of being bribed, of being biased. We're all biased. Adam karavet alatzmo. Everyone is biased relative to themselves, and yet you're allowed to do it. That's not called shochad. From which the Chazanish concludes, it must be that shochad is a chok. It is not a mishpat. Source 13. Back to our Gemara in Sanhedrin. Gemara Sanhedrin says the following. Start with cutting the line now. So we move over from bribery. We've established the prohibition of bribery. Now we move over to the question of cutting a line. Is cutting a line, what is getting someone into a university who it wasn't their place to go, is essentially cutting a line. So the Gemara here says the following. We have a hierarchy when it comes to lines. Just finished Yeshiva Week. Half the world was in Disney. There's a lot of lines in Disney. There's a lot of Yiddish cup who try to figure out how to cut the line in Disney. You bring a doctor's note that my kid has, irritable bowel syndrome, front of the line. Every kid's on ADD medication, front of the line. I knew Walt Disney, front of the line. Right. Yeah, exactly. Talk about cutting the line. Mamash, every time I fly JetBlue, Fort Lauderdale to New York, there's a miracle that happens. If you have a problem with your hip or your knee, your back, I want to tell you about a skula. There's an amazing miracle that happens 30,000 feet in the air. On the way into the airplane, everybody's in a wheelchair. They could be the first ones on the plane. The plane lands. It's mamash, it's a nes nigla. They run right off the plane. Those blue chips have such a medicinal impact. It's absolutely incredible. Stick a blue chips and you can run right down the aisle. Because now if you want to take the wheelchair when you land, now you're the last one off the plane. So it's a miracle in the sky. Literally, you want to get on the plane for the Jewish roots? I say this without—I don't mean to laugh. It's tragic. It's embarrassing. It's particularly on the Jewish roots, i.e., Fort Lauderdale to JFK and back. The lineup of the wheelchairs at the gate, mamish, goes all the way back to TSA check-in, all the way back. Everybody needs a wheelchair to be the first one on. You land. Psh, so what are the ethics? If you don't need a wheelchair, what are the ethics of using the wheelchair? What are the ethics of cutting the line? Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof, Gemara Sanhedrin Lamed Beis, Source 13. The Brisa says, Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof, Echad Adin Ve'echad L'Pshara. This Pasuk, why does it say Tzedek Tzedek? We gave one Pshat based on the Medrash. Tzedek, Bit Tzedek Tirdof. The Gemara here has another conclusion. Echad Adin Ve'echad L'Pshara. We have two forms of Tzedek. There are two forms of righteousness. There's what we call din, which is the strict interpretation of the law. And then we have a type of tzedek which is called pshara. What is the type of tzedek called pshara? Rabbi Soloveitchik had big discussion about this and beautiful insights into this, which if we were learning Sanhedrin, we talk about more in depth, not really for now. Rabbi Soloveitchik said, pshara is not just compromise. It's not that you say he owes you $1,000. He says he owes you $0. So I'll tell you what we'll do. $500 and we'll call it a day. You know what the definition of a compromise is? Something neither party's happy with, but both parties can live with. That is the definition of a compromise. Neither party's happy about, but both parties can live with. That's why they were willing to make that compromise. So a compromise doesn't mean, well, you said zero, you said 100, we'll say 50. That's not how it works. Pshara karov ladin. It's got to be a compromise which includes elements of what the din is. So tzedek tzedek, it repeats it twice because there are two types of justice. There's the strict justice based on the strict rules, and then there's the spirit of justice where one is looking to create peace. So you come up with a compromise. But pshara is a form of din. It's pshara krov ladin. Very, very important. So says the Gemara Ketzad, how do we see this? Shtei svinos over us benahar. You have two boats traveling on the river. Upagu ze beze, and they encounter each other. Im ovros shtein tovos. So what happens if both try to cross the river at the same time? They're going to collide. They're going to sink. You're going to have a car accident. You get to a four-way stop sign. Who gets to go first? That's essentially the question. You get to a four-way stop sign. Bezachar ze shtein ovros. But if they go one after the other, then they're both going to be able to pass. You have two camels who are ascending up Beit Charon. It's very narrow and very steep. If they try to go at the same time, simultaneously, they'll collide, and they're both going to fall off the cliff. If they go in succession, then they'll both be able to ascend successfully. So HaKeit said, what's the halacha? Who should go first? So, says the Gemara, Te'una v'she'ena te'una, if one of them is loaded up, one of them is carrying a heavy load, it goes before the one that has no load or the lighter load. If one of them is close to the destination and the other is farther, so we sheina krova What if they're equal distance, or they're of equal weight, or they're of equal amount of passengers? So they pay a fee one to the other. In other words, the owner of the first one compensates the owner of the one that waits, because time is money. And if you have to wait for the other, you're going to incur a loss. There's a time. Time is money. So if the one who wants to go first pays for the right to go first, otherwise if they are equal. So the Gemara is basically saying that not all who wait on a line are created equal. There's a hierarchy to a line. There's a hierarchy to who goes first. Even if they get there at the same time, if one is closer, it goes before the one is further. If one weighs more, is a heavier load, it goes before the one with the lighter load. If one has more passengers, it goes before the one who has fewer or less passengers. The Meiri comes along, and the Meiri says, there's another variable the Gemara did not mention. The Gemara mentioned the distance, the Gemara mentioned the load, but the Gemara did not mention, but it's true, says the Meiri, source 14. The Chen Kokiyotseba, about five lines from the bottom. Kol Shanu Ro'an Sheyachol Lizbol Ha'ikov B'yoser Yidcheb Nechavero. Somebody who can suffer the line longer than the other should wait longer. V'chein Barim Ne'achola V'chein Chayotse B'zeh. If you have a healthy person, they should let the sick person go first. That's the wheelchairs, but they have to be legitimately sick. The healthy person doesn't have to allow the healthy person in a wheelchair to go before them. Healthy person has to let the sick person go before them. So you have the waiting room of a Beis Din, and there are lots of cases waiting to be heard by the Beis Din. You don't necessarily follow the order in which they arrived. What's the order or the hierarchy that you set, says the Meiri? The Yasom, the orphan goes before the widow, and the widow before the Talmud Chacham, and the Talmud Chacham before the Amma Aretz. V'isha kodemes l'ish, and a woman goes before a man. Now, if everybody's equal, you have a waiting room full of orphans or widows or Talmidei Chachamim or women or so on. If all are equal, now you go in order of arrival. Now first come, first serve. But this notion that we were brought up on, that the ethics of a line is first come, first serve, is not the Torah ethics of a line. The halacha of the line is, Talmud Chacham can cut the line. We'll see in a moment. It's not a good idea to follow this. We'll see in a moment. But we can manipulate the line. So the Gemara gave certain variables, which one is a further distance, which one is a heavier load, and the Meiri throws in all these other variables. If you're more patient, Yachol Lizbol Ha'ikov Biyoser, last week's Parsha, Tachas Sivlos Mitzrayim, I quoted the Sfas Emes in my article last week, Sivlos, we should run out of our patience for Mitzrayim, we should be impatient for the moral depravity of a world in which we live. Rav Volba says, Sivlos comes from the word Savlanut. It's the same root. Sivlos, the burdens, and Savlanut. Because what does it mean to be patient? It means the capacity to be patient is the capacity to wait. It's the willingness to be burdened. It is the ability to be foreboding, forbearing. It's the ability to suffer, suffrage. It's the ability to suffer a little bit. So the Miri says the one who can suffer should wait longer than the one who can't stand to wait, and so on. He has this hierarchy. The Netziv says you have to compromise. Kosha, my case, of chilui my pshara, el mishom the mishkachas asar al pashon or bofen shkoven lasas pesher. Tilu kol pshara shlanasa el bratzen bal din. Har mistom yodim betuchim b'shnei psharim shleyotim pshara al tzad echad yosmin chaveru. V'mlach shlachach ar yinu da asin am shayu. V'lo shayach hazar asar sa Torah. El al kain, mayri bofen shkoven lasas pshara. V'yash shalahamid al din. Mishamachi, shor latana, ketzit kofan lasas pshara. V'mefarsh gon shtei svinos. The Netziv is trying to understand. The Gemara said tzedek refers to din and pshara. And what's an example of pshara? When you get the intersection at the same time and you're all created equal, and how do you come up with your compromise? The notion of we force a compromise. Because in the absence of the compromise, one will destroy the other. You don't say when you get to the intersection, whoever's stronger gets to bully their way and beat up the other and go through. We don't say that. So the notion of tzedek of din, and tzedek of shara means that we sometimes force the idea of a compromise. Where did the Meiri get this idea that you can manipulate the line? Where did the Meiri get this idea that Talmidei Chachamim have a higher priority on the line? Mirtz Hashem, I'll have to start with this next week. So next week we'll talk about, again, the priority on line. Do we really, let me just fast forward a little bit. Tshuva Sanaga says, no Talmid Chacham should ever try to cut a line, because he says, oh, the Meiri and the Shulchan Aruch, we'll see, the Shulchan Aruch also quotes, that a Talmid Chacham has a higher priority. No Talmid Chacham should ever try to practice this. Just to fast forward to next week, the Tshuva Sanaga, source 23, says, the Balabatim's job is to let the Talmid Chacham go first, and the Talmid Chacham's job is to say, I don't want any preferential treatment by being a Talmid Chacham. Each one should do what they're supposed to do. So the Meir is right, in principle. And the halacha is correct, that the Talmid Chacham gets a higher hierarchy in the line. But the Talmid Chacham shouldn't take advantage of it, because the end will be Yatzchar Befsedo. It won't be a kavod Torah. It'll end up hurting Torah when people see that the Talmid Chacham looks like they try to cut the line because they're Talmid Chacham. We'll pick up with that in Mirtz Hashem next week. And we'll begin. We have many, many, many case studies to go through about how do we apply this principle in terms of getting into the assisted living facility, getting into the cheder and the yeshiva, in terms of how it applies actually to the world of bribery and the world of protection.